Good morning and welcome to this edition of Talking About California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host. I'm a fellow in environmental history at the University of California, Berkeley, and I'm director of the Mendocino Institute, a not-for-profit research and education center on the coast. Today we'll have a look at healthcare in California. The news just happens to be all about the Affordable Health Care Act and the Supreme Court. So let's do something a little different. Let's look at the issues a little closer to home, to healthcare here in California. Our guest today is Paul Kumar. Paul is a San Francisco-based public policy and communications consultant whose clients include the National Union of Healthcare Workers, the Hotel and Restaurant Workers Union, Unite Here, the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, and the Courage Campaign, California's progressive online organizing hub. Paul played a key role in the overhaul of California's home care and nursing home financing systems, also in the enactment of California's Comprehensive Bill of Rights for Consumers of Managed Care, and in the passage of the Hospital Pricing Protections for Low-Income and Uninsured Individuals. He worked on drafting and the adoption of San Francisco's groundbreaking universal health care plan, as well as on several different efforts at statewide comprehensive health care reform. So good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Cal. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Let's begin with some questions about healthcare in California. As you know, I've spent a little time hanging around the National Union of Healthcare Workers, where I often hear healthcare referred to as an industry. And, of course, I've wondered about that. It sounds a little far from the sort of bedside doctor and nurse. Could you help us with that? Why an industry? Why do we call something like healthcare an industry?
You know, well, to start with, we live in a capitalist society, and it's very hard to insulate any major social process, even one that's so integral to people's well-being and taken for granted by so many people, from the pressures that money and the opportunities to make money bring. And the reality is a lot of major players in healthcare are businesses. Certainly, everyone is painfully aware of the extent to which healthcare systems are driven by decisions insurers make, what care to pay for, what care to deny, what care to emphasize, what care to de-emphasize. But beyond insurance, which is largely, although not universally, a for-profit industry, it so happens that the state's major hospital systems, while most of them are nominally not-for-profit, really behave in a competitive way in their markets very much as they would if they were companies on the New York Stock Exchange. They are aggressively trying to grab market share. They're trying to consolidate ownership of facilities in order to drive their purchasing power, their pricing power with insurance companies. Arguably the main cost driver of our increased healthcare expenditures in recent years is just as much the consolidation of the state's hospital systems as it is technological advances the additional treatments that are available through pharmaceuticals. It's a major driver of the cost spiral in healthcare. The nursing home industry is notoriously, over the last 40 years, been taken over for the most part by large national and regional for-profit chains. So there's a lot of money in healthcare, about one-fifth of our gross domestic product, and where there's that much money, there's going to be business.
And so we have public, we have private. What would you say is the balance? And then maybe you could just make clear for our listeners the distinctions between, say, acute care, long-term care, and so on.
Certainly. Well, in California is rather unique compared to many states in that it still has a relatively robust public healthcare delivery infrastructure. Actually, you know, publicly owned and operated facilities, largely county hospitals, although in some counties there are also county skilled nursing facilities, which are basically, you know, nursing homes that take care of people who require either rehabilitative care or longer-term, you know, medically supervised care that is not immediately life-threatening, to make a gross distinction. You know, in California, although county operations of hospitals have, you know, pared back quite a bit, still in many of the state's largest counties, and as well as in some rural counties, there are major public hospitals that are absolutely essential providers of services, both services that everyone needs and uses, like trauma care. And most often, the way the design has worked, these public hospitals are also what we refer to commonly as safety net hospitals, meaning they take a vastly disproportionate share of the load of caring for people who are without insurance or who are on publicly sponsored insurance plans like Medi-Cal that do not pay the same rates as private insurance that you might get through your employer or buy on the market. And so there's a division, for lack of a better description, there's a division of labor in a lot of California between a publicly operated and funded system that serves, lower income Californians to a large degree, undocumented immigrants, people who are in rural areas, and that the major hospital chains have no interest in staffing, in serving because it doesn't fit into their business plan, and the rest of the state's hospitals, which are divided between a few different players. Just to be quick about it, in the not-for-profit sector, Kaiser Permanente, which is a group model HMO, is also the state's major hospital provider, along with a company called Catholic Healthcare West, which is changing its name now to Dignity Health, exactly because it's starting to operate outside of the strictly diocesan and religious order-controlled world of Catholic healthcare. Then there's also in Northern California, many of your listeners will be familiar with a firm named Sutter Health, which is arguably the single most aggressive player in Northern California from a business standpoint, in both what it buys, what it shuts down, how it prices its services to insurers.
Now, was it not-for-profit?
They are all nominally not-for-profit. And these nominally not-for-profit companies, in the case of Sutter Health, for example, not this last year, but the year before, made $878 billion in profit. So these entities are making surpluses that have, no clear and direct relationship to being applied to meet community needs. They are being applied in some fashion or form to healthcare, but the healthcare they choose to provide is care that fits into their business plan, not care that's lacking for people in California. And this is true to a greater or lesser extent with all of these major not-for-profits. Perhaps Sutter is the worst offender in Northern California.
Was that million or billion, Paul?
$878 million.
Right, okay.
Right? Their numbers for the most recently reported year are down a little because they took some investment losses that I'm still trying to figure out, but I imagine that those aren't, those were business choices rather than actual losses as well. We should all run. If you were a business person, Sutter would be a good model to follow. If you're a healthcare patient, not so much.
Well, probably everybody in California knows something about Kaiser Permanente. It has a long history and often is presented as a kind of a model HMO, a model provider. But looking at some numbers recently, I noticed that it had what do we call them? Profits in the billions, I think, over the last couple of years. And right. CEO Halvorsen, George Halvorsen is that his name, who has what an income of $9 million a year. How do they square those numbers with their projected image?
I'm not sure they can, Cal. It's a topic of significant discussion, debate, and concern inside Kaiser Permanente, exactly what they have to do to protect their not-for-profit tax status every year. And some of the choices they're making, like the ones you mentioned, make it harder. To be fair to Kaiser, as you said, it has a long-standing reputation as a provider of high-quality care, and through a philosophy of coordination. I mean, at some level, they are a progenitor of what I would refer to as the legitimate purposes of managed care, to coordinate care better and to ensure people get the right kinds of care, and aren't driven into inappropriate kinds of care by financial incentives. But they, too, operate in a marketplace, and they've had to adjust their business model to keep up with the Joneses, shall we say. And it's resulted in some exorbitant practices and a need for exorbitant margins. So you're right. Over the last 3 years, they had net income profits of about $6.1 billion, and they now have 15 or more top executives that make over $1 million a year in compensation. And most of these individuals are also eligible for multiple pension plans, as many as 8, in fact. The argument they make really is that in order to operate a health system that on a charitable basis that moves all of its money back into the delivery of services at the level of quality that's required, they need to be competitive, to have talent that can manage something like that, and that's what they should do, and that they need those kinds of margins to deal with the volatility in the healthcare market, to deal with the potential impacts of healthcare reform, which are very uncertain. There's every rationale in the book, but I think most people can see through these rationales enough to know that a lot of it's just about making money.
So when we see a company like Adventist and Sutter also in Santa Rosa sort of moving north in our direction, that's what we can expect, what you're telling us?
Well, what you can expect, and there are different versions of this, but what you can expect is an attempt to monopolize by most of these entities, not all of them, to be fair, but to monopolize services that are attractive to them from a business standpoint. For example, as a general rule, hospitals that provide a great deal of cardiac care can command very high prices and margins for it. Same with orthopedic care. Very often, hospitals want to provide obstetric care, childbirthing services, because it's understood as a gateway service. Once a family has an experience of going through childbirth somewhere, they have an emotional identification with the hospital. And this is a matter of business management, not of speculation. And it's common. And you'll see an attempt to build up those services, an attempt to fob off some of the other services on county operations, on other private not-for-profit safety net providers who really are financially struggling, whether they're clinics or small hospitals. But as a general rule, while it may be a little bit different in Mendocino County and some other parts of the state that are more rural, in most of the state and in most of the country, the days of a real community hospital that provides a full spectrum of care from A to Z are over.
Another important category of employment and of care is the home care worker. I don't think you've said much about them. Now they seem to be a very complicated position in terms of who employs them and what they do. Would you mind? And they seem to be under threat, by the way, in the new budgets being proposed in Sacramento. Could you shed some light on these people?
Sure, and let me first make a quick distinction. When we talk about home care colloquially, we often mean many different things. There is, just to go through them in sort of broad categories, there's home care paid for by Medicare, which is really tends to be much shorter term, and rehabilitative, and to involve a higher degree of medical supervision. It's medicalized. Then there's home care provided by Medicaid, which most often, not always, but most often is really what one would call personal assistance services. It's helped that personnel who have very, exceptional people skills, but not necessarily much or any technical training can provide. And then there is the biggest sector of all, the so-called informal sector of home care, which, our families and neighbors and friends struggling to provide support for, their loved ones and relations who need help at home. And I think it's fair to say that every one of those sectors is under strain. The biggest one in California that you often hear about in the news is the Medicaid sector that I talked about, Medi-Cal. And the program through which it provides these personal assistance services is called the In-Home Supportive Services Program, IHSS.
And what would one of these people do on a day in, a day out basis?
They provide help with everything from bathing and toileting to feeding and dressing. And under the way the law is currently structured, they still can provide their authorized hours by county social workers who monitor the system, very often to provide some support doing household chores, cleaning, cooking, other things that allow people to remain independent rather than be driven into more expensive and less healthy institutionalized settings like a nursing home. Because very often a relatively limited amount of support can keep somebody what we call aging in place, being able to change your life circumstances, both physical and in terms of human support, that will allow you to remain in your own home. And of course, by the way, just to be clear, it's not simply a matter of aging. These services are available to people with disabilities of any age, if they are disabled and qualified for them economically.
And so that sounds pretty important. What will be the result of budgetary cuts?
Well, there's already the good news is that a coalition of the stakeholders in the system have successfully challenged most of the cuts that have been attempted by the state in the courts, although there is, and without going into minute detail, there were attempts by both Governor Schwarzenegger and then later Governor Brown really to gut the program, to disqualify for services entirely at some points in time as much as 40% of the services that are provided, by ending chore assistance, by disqualifying care provided by family members who live in the same domicile with you, which is a big part of the service. And by the way, once again, it's a matter of health policy. There are clinical studies that are made clear that getting this kind of care from someone who you know and you are comfortable with produces a better outcome. So it's not, but it's very often when it comes to budget cutting time, it's easy for budget hawks to talk about it like it's a slush fund, it's graft, it's a subsidy for your family who should be caring for you anyway because they're your family, all this kind of thing. When the reality is, your family can't, if you need care, your family can only care for you a certain number of hours in the day because they have to work. And if their ability to work a little bit less in the outside world is made up for by a relatively low rate of reimbursement for the work they do, for their poor relative who otherwise would be in a nursing home costing the state hundreds of dollars a day, it's good economics, it's good health policy. So anyway, sorry to be so elliptical, Cal. Most of the cuts have been staved off for now, but there have been some across the board cuts in hours, although thankfully relatively limited so far. But there's you know, easily at a minimum of 20% potential cut in hours in service, hours of service on the table. And there is also a renewed threat that hasn't been out there now for a couple of years to directly go after the level of state payment for providers' wages. The way the system works, in IHSS, there are three different payers that contribute to it. The federal government contributes somewhat more than 50% of the money. That amount just got increased as a function of some of the early steps in healthcare reform. And, excuse me, the county and the state split the rest of the cost, with the state providing two-thirds and the county providing one-third. And but the driving policy decisions in terms of what to pay the workers are really made at the state level in large measure, because they decide up to what level of, you know, wages they will provide matching payments for their two-thirds share. And there was an attempt several years ago to cut the maximum level they would match, you know, down to $9 an hour from $11.50, and that was held up in the courts because there wasn't sufficient proof that it wouldn't result in the denial of service to people for lack of ability to recruit anyone to work for $9 an hour. But there is a renewed advocacy, in fact, on the part of the state legislative analyst's office to say the economy's changed, there are huge numbers of unemployed, the argument that you're not going to be able to find people to provide care at these lower levels of wages and benefits probably doesn't hold anymore. The state should think about rolling back wages as a more workable.
$9 an hour versus an annual income of $9 million. I guess that's what the 1%, 99% is all about.
Exactly.
Just one more area before we switch, and quickly, how do nursing homes fit into the big picture of healthcare in California?
The snake pit that everyone wants to avoid. Nursing homes are let me dial back on that a little bit. There are an enormous number of extraordinary workers who work under impossible conditions to provide loving care to people in nursing homes. They're some of the hardest. They have some of the hardest jobs anywhere in the healthcare industry. And by the way, the highest rate of injury of almost any worker in the United States, from lifting injuries in particular. But the companies, so much of the care in nursing homes is provided by really cutthroat for-profit companies, both national and regional, that understand how to game the government payment systems to maximize their profits at the expense of good care. That, you know, the horror stories that come out of nursing homes, some of them are just a function of nursing homes being a place where relatively unwell people spend, you know, often the last days of their lives. But it's also a function of care that could be greatly improved if staffing were better and the quality of materials provided for patients' care was better. But the reality is there's a very aggressive nursing home lobby in the state. It's a very politically sensitive service in large part because the people are vulnerable who rely on nursing homes for care. And some of the attempts, including ones I was very much involved in, to try to change the system so that the government paid, you know, more money to track providing better staffing and better wages and benefits to workers to make for a higher functioning workforce and higher quality care haven't panned out perfectly because there are too many loopholes in the system that were politically forced by the industry. And one thing I should have said at the outset, Cal, and I'm sorry for not mentioning this, I mean, nursing homes, while there are some very high-end nursing homes, and I know there certainly are in Mendocino County, that are run by very often either religiously affiliated organizations or, in some instances, luxury hotel chains and so forth, and they rely heavily on private payments. So, for example, very often people will pay what's called a continuing care retirement community, a lump sum, a fixed sum that allows them to move as they become more disabled from assisted living, or maybe even a fully independent apartment to assisted living to skilled nursing facility, all within the same campus, right? That's the exception rather than the rule because it costs way too much. I mean, very often the people that are buying those kinds of services are, you know, literally paying, you know, on the order, you know, if you spread it out over the years, something like $90,000 out of their own pocket. The bulk of the nursing home industry is really entirely publicly funded. Almost it is. 2/3 or more funded by Medi-Cal, and another significant chunk, 15% or more, by Medicare for these rehabilitative services, as we were discussing before, because people very often convalescing from hospital stays will require some medical supervision on a daily basis, and those people usually end up for some short length of time in a nursing home. Because Medicare, among other things, Medicare will only pay for a short length of time. And the last thing to know is the way the system works. I mean, one of the reasons it's all Medi-Cal is, you know, when you really need to go into a nursing home, if you have any money, it will all be gone fast. And the only way to get care ultimately for the remainder of your life, or as long as you may need it, is to be divested fully of all of your assets, pretty much, and be indigent and on Medi-Cal, and that's who really resides in nursing homes. It's people who have, you know, who have spent down all of their last resources and don't have anywhere else to go.
This is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow. Our program today is talking about California. And today we're talking with Paul Kumar. Paul's a San Francisco-based public policy and communications consultant, and he's filling us in on the situation of healthcare, the healthcare industry, healthcare delivery here in the state of California. Of course, against a background of the debate now taking place in Washington, D.C. in the Supreme Court. Paul, I know that you're interested in quality health care, but you also work for unions, among other organizations. But what is the connection there? What would you say first about health care workers, and then about what we might call a connection between quality health care and the people who provide it, especially the people who we don't hear so much about, the people who aren't doctors?
Right. Well, you know, well, first and foremost, Cal, it's a principled commitment of the workers who are in the healthcare field. People don't get into the healthcare field as a general rule unless they are committed to providing their fellow neighbors, friends, family with support that they need in a time of illness. It's a special, you know, kind of person who devotes their life to caregiving or even providing support services in a facility that provides care. People are, you know, caring, tend to be, you know, patient and deeply engaged and committed to supporting people in need. And so the first thing they will want out of a union in many instances is for the union to fit in with that critical value that defines who they are. So first off, it really is part of the character of the individuals who work in the industry. The second thing is that people's ability to provide care really depends on the security of the rest of their lives and the stresses that they may be under, both in terms of the quality of life at work and in terms of their economics. If you are working, for sake of argument, if one day I'm in a nursing home, I really don't want somebody taking care of me who's on the 16th hour of her workday. There's a limit to which someone can provide another human being high-quality care, that, especially in a medically supervised setting, if they're so badly paid that they're working 2, 3, 4 jobs. And this is not an exaggeration. If you had a discussion with a group of nursing home workers, you'd find the majority of them have multiple jobs and have to juggle to make ends meet.
Maybe you could explain that. I'm not sure if you can, but what would be the multiple jobs as an example?
Somebody could be working as a nursing aide in a nursing home for 40 hours a week, and then have another 20-hour-a-week job doing that in a hospital, and then have a third job as a personal care assistant, right? Hmm. Not to mention taking jobs that have nothing to do with the healthcare industry. When you get paid as little as some of these workers do in an economy as expensive as California's, to fill in some details that I think most people are aware of in this case from their own experience, but the caregiving professions shy of actual medical doctors continue to be vastly majority female occupied positions. More and more men are taking the jobs, both because of the breakdown of some of the cultural forces that drive gender division in the workforce, and also because the unions and just the marketplace have created some pressure to raise the wages to a level where they're more attractive. But as a general rule, most of these professions are still majority female, and the lesser skilled they are, the more majority female they are. So a lot of these individuals are single, in this world that we live in, a lot of them are single women with low incomes and children, or people who are responsible for multi-generational families, including their parents. And, they live hard lives, and knowing that you can manage on a regular 40 hours a week or a little more and will have enough to pay your bills at the end of the month. And for some of these people, certainly in the hospital world in California where wages have increased substantially, can pay a mortgage, put aside some money to help your kids go through college. The whole quality of life for that sector of work has drastically changed in hospitals in this state. It has not really changed anywhere near as much for workers in the other healthcare sectors. So, I hope that answers the question somewhat. I mean, one last thing I'll add, which really isn't about economics, is more about the behavior of employers. It is, if not universal, almost universal, that healthcare enterprises that treat their workers badly also treat their patients and clients and residents that they're supposed to be providing care for badly, and vice versa. There are very few companies that treat, that are derelict in their responsibilities to provide care, but that somehow treat their workers well. The two things go hand in hand. So it really is a sort of unified field where the workers, by inclination, by the reality of their circumstances, need to fight continuously for improvements both in their own standards of living and standards of work, and to ensure the commitment of their employers to providing quality care.
I think that staffing is always a big issue in this area. I ask you if you would agree with that, and that it has been a big issue. I'm sure you are. Are you familiar with the National Union of Healthcare Workers project? Let's see, it's care delayed, care denied, about the issue, I think, of staffing and mental health areas, and that it's become a contentious issue in contract negotiations at Kaiser. Are you familiar with that?
I'm very familiar with it. I'm a contributor to that study.
Could you tell us what's going on there?
Well, yes, absolutely. First off, when people think about staffing issues in healthcare, the first thing I think most of your listeners' minds go to are the number of nurses that are available for them when they're in the hospital. As most of your listeners know, there is now a much more robust RN, registered nurse staff ratio law in place. Very much credit to the California Nurses Association for that. That has begun to address the understaffing of those critical caregivers in a hospital. But that's not the only place where there's understaffing. In the healthcare system, as we've discussed, there's certainly horrendous understaffing in nursing homes, but it's also true with specialty care. And the paper that you were talking about, Cal, Care Delayed, Care Denied, is the result of several thousand mental health care providers, PhD psychologists, licensed clinical social workers, marriage and family therapists who work for Kaiser Permanente, seeking to hold Kaiser accountable to provide timely and appropriate services to its policyholders. To make a long story short, these workers have been fighting for years and years and years to address several very serious shortcomings in the mental health services at Kaiser. Number one, people simply wait too long for the care that they need. They're delayed getting in the door, and once they're in, their return appointments are delayed beyond a point where they're actually as effective at treating their problems, right? So that's number one. The second is they often don't get offered treatment that's really the best for them. For example, group therapy is very useful as a tool in the mental health profession, but it's not useful for every condition or for everybody. And very often, Kaiser patients, we found talking to these clinicians, were being pushed into group therapy when it wasn't effective for them, and very often with the result that people simply dropped out of the therapy, or they ended up paying out of their own pockets to hire providers outside of Kaiser to give them the care that Kaiser wouldn't give them. And there is also a whole lot of sort of bells and whistles and tricks that we found were being used to create an impression that people were getting timely and appropriate care when they weren't, and clearly the intent of the bells and whistles was to mask the reality. So, for example, we found that in a number of Kaiser facilities, when they track how long people have to wait for appointments, as they're required to do now by law, just by their own management practice, one would think, they would do things like, have people call in for appointments, but record it as if they had been asking merely for an orientation. And then when they got there for the orientation, which sometimes might have been a six-week wait, for example, sometimes much shorter, but that's a real-life example. Once they arrived, they would either be brought directly into an appointment in some places such that the record would show that there was no wait time at all, when in fact they'd been waiting 6 weeks, just to give you one egregious example. So what we found and what we allege is that this is While it's not uniform at every Kaiser facility how they do these things, there's a general pattern of these problems and inappropriate mechanisms to deny people the care that they need broadly throughout the Kaiser system. And this complaint that arose from this white paper is now being investigated by the Department of Managed Health Care very seriously, because these clinicians provide a level of detail and evidence that makes it unquestionable that something wrong is going on.
And one last related question. Healthcare for healthcare workers, as everywhere it seems today, employers want concessions from their employees, and especially employers seem to be unhappy with contributions to pensions and to healthcare benefits. But it's a little hard for me, I guess, to quite understand this when we talk about the great profit that's being made in the healthcare industry and the expansion, the growth of this industry. It's difficult to understand exactly why, say, hospital chains would want to take away healthcare benefits from healthcare workers. That would seem to be a perk we'd all want. Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, Cal, there's an old quote from Willie Sutton, the 30s-era gangster, and someone asked him, why is it that you rob banks? He said, that's where the money is. If they can shift costs onto workers, and there's a lot of their money that's going into providing health care that they might get back if the workers ate some of that cost, they're going to go for it. And there's a lot of cultural pressure around them from other employers and from just the spirit of the times, this notion of shared sacrifice and your personal responsibility is going to produce a better result than being let off scot-free. You should bear some of the risk yourself if you are not so healthy, because after all, you might be contributing to that. I mean, didn't you eat a cookie last Saturday, and aren't you 12 pounds overweight? And maybe every once in a while you drink too much, and there's a whole bunch of stuff that's disparate and appeals to people's better nature that's being used against them here. The notion is that people are trying to improve health and reduce costs for everybody by making everybody a stakeholder in keeping costs down, but there is nothing out there that really suggests that the result of these kinds of moves does anything more than save employers money. It to the extent it may result in people watching certain problems more closely, it also tends to result in people not getting care because they don't want to pay the copays. It's a double-edged sword at best, and it's being sold. It's a bill of goods. It's being sold to workers in sugar-coated ways, but most workers can see through it. I mean, people know when they're being socked with more costs from the boss. The part of the thing, I mean, I know you're familiar, Cal, with the notion of disaster capitalism. During this so-called Great Recession, there has been a massive offensive by the business community to convince people that the only way to right the economy is for everybody to get whacked. And it's a very hard ideological wave to push back against. But there are some workers' organizations, consumer advocates, others that are fighting back. And when we fight back, sometimes we win.
Okay, this is KZYX. Today we're talking about California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host, and again, I'm talking to our guest, Paul Kumar, who is a San Francisco-based policy consultant and communications consultant. We have a little bit of time left, about go to the last part of our program here. Let me shift the discussion a bit I may be wrong here, and you can please correct me, but it's my take that if the Affordable Care Act makes it through the Supreme Court, it might be considerably less than what we need, and that it might not survive at all. So, Paul, I wonder if you might speculate a little bit or tell us what's actually been done in the past about what might be done right here in California to get healthcare coverage, healthcare program that would work for us. Big question, but, you know, maybe you have some suggestions.
Well, I can certainly give you some background and perspective. We'll see whether my suggestions are all that good. You know, the United States is an anomaly in the industrialized world, or in fact, anywhere in the world, in the structure of its healthcare system. To make a very long story as short as I can, the provision of healthcare benefits, insurance through employment, became widespread, really only during and then, after World War II, when wages were frozen, people looked for other ways to provide support for their employers, and it turned into, there were always mutual insurance systems that were often connected with or organized through workplaces for, many years prior. But the notion of employer-based healthcare being a widespread benefit really is a notion that comes out of both a World War II experience and the failure of an effort to achieve a national healthcare system immediately after World War II, and some decisions made, including by unions, instead to institutionalize healthcare as part of the employment package. It's what most of us grew up being used to who grew up in America. And for a whole bunch of reasons, it's a really bad system because it creates, small pockets of, in many instances, workers and even employers who have no ability to, manage or even engage rationally in the organization of the services they receive, and they have to rely on an entire industry of insurance and consultants and middle people who all, of course, add an enormous amount of cost to the system, and all of this is predicated, of course, on the fundamental issue, which is there isn't a fully government-financed healthcare system, a centrally financed system in place in the United States, like there is in most of the rest of certainly the industrialized world. And there's a huge ideology, once again, to use the I word, that's been driven to create fear of what you often hear derided by, for example, the Republican members of the House of Representatives as government-run healthcare. The notion is somehow that this entity government, which really is a collective vehicle of all of us to provide for the common good, if it's the financing system for healthcare, forget about actually monitoring or delivering care, even if it's just used to collect money and to set some standards to make sure everybody gets decent care, that it will result in, a bunch of people who are far beyond your reach making irrational decisions that put you at risk and that you're really better off fending for yourself in the marketplace. Well, and we can see the results. Americans are less healthy, pay an enormous amount more than any comparable country for their care, and the for-profit industry here is booming in a way that doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. So, to make that story, it wasn't so short, but the moral of the story is, we have spent now many, many, many years, certainly since President Clinton's effort to reform healthcare in the early 90s, trying to get ourselves out of what is fundamentally an irrational system of care, both from a care perspective and from a financial perspective. And The hybrid that has emerged is really a function of politics. And when I say politics, I don't just mean electoral politics. I mean the politics of power and money. Obviously, the insurance industry has enormous resources and wants to keep its role in the healthcare system, and has spent a lot of money scaring people that anything that diminishes their role will put care at risk. And there are major trade organizations that have spent a ton of money each to protect their own silos. And so what you have is a sort of amalgam. People have netted what you see as, people call derisively, whether fair or not, Obamacare, or sometimes Republicans will, refer to their fellow traveler, Governor Romney, and talk about Romney Care. Well, these systems are very close to the same design, and what they really are hybrids that, rather than set up a government financing system, like what we might call commonly, single payer, a unitary one single financing system, which can also involve either one purchasing system or it can be spread out amongst trust funds like it is, different competing, intermediaries like it is in some countries in Western Europe. Instead of doing that, what it does is it preserves the role of private insurers, but it creates a more standardized set of choices that consumers can understand. It produces substantial subsidies for people who have difficulty getting insurance in the private market the way it's currently set up, or whose employers are now backing out of paying insurance. But in large measure, what we're witnessing here is the winding down of employment-based insurance, and it's a very painful process. And the ability to win a comprehensive reform that really does away with all the irrationality in the system isn't there. I mean, some of your listeners may remember that there was a very specific half step, I would call it, that was the focus of a lot of debate in passing Obama's package, the so-called public option. That was very much a focus group and poll-driven design, although the actual policy concept came from an academic, a Yale-based academic named Jacob Hacker. But fundamentally, the policy tracked the politics, which were, people were scared enough at being forced out of what they currently knew that you had to give them the notion they could keep what they got, what they already had. And the only way to create a so-called public option was for it exactly to be an option. And you all have seen how savagely that was attacked and ultimately destroyed, and so that it's not, a part of Obamacare. So that's not a California update, but that's an update on the broad contours that we're dealing with now.
And necessary. Thank you. And what about California? Is there anything that you might want to say about that?
Yeah, just very quickly, because I know we're running out of time. First off, whether or not you think there's any progress that's made available through so-called Obamacare, or whether the damage it causes by leaving insurers in place is more than the benefit that it provides by getting a lot more people into coverage. Here in California, people deserve a lot of credit. The consumer advocates in particular, but also even some of our state legislators and the state administration as well, for getting out in front of the curve and trying to make it work. California is far ahead of other states in terms of creating what I would call a glide path for uncovered people into coverage. There are a bunch of systems now being set up, including so-called low-income health programs in counties that will basically pre-enroll people into organized systems of care that will ultimately be paid for by Medi-Cal under the healthcare reform if it stands up to challenges in court. And there's an exchange board, which is perhaps too conservative for my liking, but this exchange that's being set up as part of healthcare reform to basically create a common marketplace for the purchase of policies that all have to meet common standards, at least is advanced, and there is active debate and discussion about what those policies are going to look like in California. And thank goodness for all of us, Unlike some states, I mean, the Obama administration, something it's done recently that has not gotten a lot of notice, is it did something that I think is a very poor decision from, as a matter of policy. It gave states way too much flexibility so that some states are going to dumb down what these policies look like so that they really don't give people the care they need. In California, I think that's much less likely because we've had robust advocacy around these things. So, while I don't think it's a final solution to the irrationality of the healthcare system, I think we can make reform in California function in ways that are beneficial to millions of people and that can't be written off entirely.
And what about, Paul, just going off on our own, as people have talked about in the past and as what seems to be being discussed in Vermont today? Is that an option?
I think it's an option that people are trying to figure out how to make happen. I mean, as you know, Cal, there have been ballot measures in California to create a single-payer system in the past, and despite a lot of high hopes, they've gone down in flames, and whether or not the difficulties people will have in the aftermath of Obamacare implementation set the stage for another chance at that is really in question. I think everybody agrees that the deeper grassroots education and organization building that are necessary to fight off the insurance industry onslaught it needs to operate at an entirely different level. In a state where mass marketing controls these decisions, you can run one kind of campaign in Vermont, and you need a different one in California. But there, once again, our friends at the California Nurses Association and others are trying to figure out the next and best step forward to make single payer healthcare an option, and it's important to keep that struggle alive and hopefully find ways to win it.
You mentioned a couple of organizations. Could listeners get in touch with the Nurses Association or with the Courage Campaign? Would that be something to look into?
Well, I think if you go to Courage Campaign, and I don't know if it's my apologies, .org or .com, you will be kept up on a lot of the sort of cross-cutting issues that progressives in California are dealing with. It's an email list very well worth getting on. And in particular, also, I would alert people, it's an organization that's played a leading role in the national struggle for lesbian and gay and bisexual and transgender rights. Cal Nurses are at calnurses.org, and you will see updates both on their struggles to hold employers accountable in the workplace and in Sacramento and nationally. And last of all, not least, you mentioned from the start, the National Union of Healthcare Workers is nuhw.org. An independent, democratic, strong trade union for non-RN healthcare workers. For the most part, we actually represent some RNs in Southern California that should play a bigger and bigger role in building a movement for healthcare reform in the coming years.
Paul, that's been very interesting. A terrific explanation. I think we've all learned a great deal from that. So I'd really like to thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. This is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow. Our program is Talking About California. And we'll be coming back next Thursday at this same time, 9 a.m. And we look forward to talking to you again. Paul, thanks very much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Cal.